This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharisa, the editor-in-chief over at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 29 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. I've got this little dog named Henry. He's a 15-pound Maltese Shih Tzu mix, and he's dope AF. He just turned 7, and he has more personality than a lot of humans do, especially humans who analyze fantasy football for a living. Henry's on a special diet because the dude is allergic to literally everything. He eats this weird mix of duck and potatoes now. Literally, for every meal, it's duck and potatoes. Though, I guess for a dog, it could be a lot worse. Anyway, my wife and I get his food delivered to our house so that we don't have to go to the vet and pick it up every time he runs out. And it's on a set schedule because it's pretty easy to predict when he'll run out of food. And knowing when he'll run out of food even before he runs out of food is a huge advantage for budgeting purposes and honestly for storage purposes, because he gets a lot of food when it's delivered. There's a lot of duck and potatoes that come to our front door when it gets delivered. Despite being a small dog, Henry can crush some cans of duck and potato. This is a prime example of why and how predictability can be super useful and helpful. In fantasy football, and this is just a personal subjective opinion, I think the notion of predictability is really overlooked. I'm not talking about, I think this guy will finish as a wide receiver too at the end of the season. I mean predictability in terms of how we're making start-sit decisions each week. Every day during fantasy football season, my Twitter mentions blow up with people asking start-sit questions. Should I start Frank Gore or Rob Kelly, they ask. But the question is never, does Frank Gore have more predictable output than Rob Kelly does? Or which positions in fantasy football are most predictable? I've alluded to this concept many, many times on previous podcasts, but I figured I'd do a show on it because, like I said, I think it's an overlooked idea within the community, especially when you consider how focused people are on season-long projections and not how those points are actually accumulated. So predictability, as I like to call it, is simply how foreseeable a certain performance is. Think of it this way. You're setting up a lineup each week, and within your lineup, you're asking yourself, should I play this guy or this guy? It's a lot easier to make those decisions when you're confident about how a player is going to perform. Predictability isn't just about individual players either. It's about positions. For instance, of all four of the big positions in fantasy football, so quarterbacks, tight ends, running backs, wide receivers, quarterback is by far the most predictable. It makes sense intuitively. They're dropping back to pass 30 plus times per game, and as a result, you have a larger sample on them heading into a particular contest. But moreover, fantasy scoring just sort of makes them more predictable because quarterbacks are gaining some sort of points in fantasy for almost any action they take on the field. And since they make so many actions in a game, their floor is fundamentally higher than other positions in fantasy. In other words, a quarterback's variance from a weekly fantasy output standpoint may be less than what we see from other positions. I actually mentioned this on last week's mailbag episode, but there's a statistic called coefficient of variation that I've used since I started doing fantasy football writing that helps us gauge how predictable a set of data is. It tells us how much the set of data varies, or the standard deviation, divided by the set of data's mean, or average. The reason you want to look at the average in the denominator of the equation is because standard deviation alone does not tell us enough. For instance, in 2016, Drew Brees' week-to-week output had a standard deviation of 10.71 points in standard scoring leagues. Meanwhile, Lamar Miller's standard deviation in 2014 was just 6.58 PPR points. So for Drew Brees, his standard deviation was 10.71 points, Lamar Miller's was 6.58 points. This doesn't mean that Lamar Miller was a more consistent fantasy asset in 2014 than Drew Brees was last year. Since quarterbacks score the most points in fantasy football, their overall range of scoring is larger. When a set of data is more spread out, you end up getting higher standard deviations. And that's why the coefficient of variation exists. It takes standard deviation and divides it by the data set's mean in order to get more of an apples-to-apples comparison between different data sets. While Drew Brees in 2016 had a way higher standard deviation than Lamar Miller in 2014, Brees' coefficient of variation was 0.52, while Miller's was 0.53. And that's because Miller averaged 12.48 points per game, while Brees averaged 19.52. Naturally, if you think about how this math works, the closer the coefficient of variation is to zero, the less volatility within the data. because zero would imply that there's absolutely no standard deviation. So just to show you how predictable, or should I say how little variance, the quarterback position has, I divided up the position alongside the running back and wide receiver positions and bucketed players within those positions by tiers. Yeah, that probably doesn't make any sense. Basically, using the last 3 years of weekly data, which excludes week 17, I grouped all QB1s by year-end data together, so QB1 to QB6, and then I went down by sixes until QB19 to QB24. So we're looking at QB1 through QB6 as one bucket over the last 3 years, then QB7s to QB12s as another bucket, then QB13s to QB18s, and then QB19s to QB24s. In other words, I've bucketed high-end QB1s, low-end QB1s, high-end QB2s, and low-end QB2s. Make sense? Over the last three seasons, the average coefficient of variation among the QB1 to QB6 group has been 0.47. Among the next group, it's 0.52, the next group is 0.56, and the final group, QB19 to QB24, is 0.64. Remember, the higher the coefficient of variation, the more volatile the data set is. So this makes sense. High-end QB1s have the least amount of variance, while QB19 to QB24 show the most among quarterbacks. Doing this exercise for running backs and wide receivers, grouping them by 12 instead of 6 because you're starting at least two of them in your league instead of one, gives us some very interesting results. Among RB1 to RB12s over the last three seasons, the coefficient of variation within their weekly output was 0.64. That's the exact same figure that we saw from the QB19 to QB24 bucket that we just talked through. What this means is that a random RB1 over the last three seasons, from a weekly output standpoint, has shown similar variance as a low-end QB2. Think about what this means, people. Joe Flacco is basically just as predictable as Devontae Freeman. No, I know, I get it. It doesn't work exactly like that. David Johnson and Le'Veon Bell are certainly more predictable than Joe Flacco. But quarterbacks like Joe Flacco are just as predictable as running backs like Devontae Freeman, and that's pretty freaking crazy. After doing the exercise, and this is for PPR formats, which is incredibly important, I found that running backs start to show massive variance after the RB2 group, while wide receivers, and this is mostly again because it's PPR, are more consistent. A conclusion you could probably draw from this then is that in a PPR league, running backs may give you an interesting edge because if you can get an elite one, the advantage they give you on the predictability front is greater than what you get at wide receiver. Now, granted, that's not the case in standard formats. It's the opposite. Another conclusion to push forth from the data is that this is why quarterback streaming can be effective. When you insert variables such as a good matchup, a high implied team total, a weak secondary, and so on for a low-end quarterback, but then you know that low-end quarterback is predictable, then it's easier to pinpoint when those usable QB1 weeks are coming from unusable QB2s. This is exactly what we talk through each week on my other podcast, Living the Stream. Over the last 3 years, we've successfully streamed QB6s from a season-long standpoint by pinpointing quarterbacks owned in roughly 25% or fewer of fantasy leagues. And that's not some garbage hindsight analysis either. That's us, my podcast host Denny Carter and I, putting ourselves out there with picks and tracking them. So with zero investment, you can compile a Frankenstein quarterback who's a mid quarterback one in fantasy football. And so much of that has to do with the predictability of the position. But quite obviously, with the coefficient of variation, you can see trends in how particular players produce points. Fantasy football is a weekly game, not a yearly one. We, as analysts, players, and fans of the game, will often speak from the perspective of season-long points, but that tells us the end result, not the journey. The coefficient of variation explains the journey. One of the most common questions I've gotten over the last couple of months since I started this podcast is how I tier players before a draft. My answer is always, I'll get to it eventually on a show, I promise you. This is where I'm getting to it. Between running backs and wide receivers score points in many different ways. Jarvis Landry over the last 3 years, for example, has had a coefficient of variation that's never been above 0.63 in any given season, and in two of his seasons, it sat at 0.53 and 0.52. Just to reference the grouping method that I walked through just a second ago, Jarvis Landry's consistency is better than most wide receiver ones in fantasy football. Jarvis Landry, from a consistency standpoint, is elite. But Jarvis Landry clearly isn't an elite wide receiver in fantasy football. The reason for that is because he's not scoring the points that elite wide receivers score. So what does this tell us? It tells us that Jarvis Landry is a week-to-week floor play, not a ceiling play. When I'm tiering my players, I like to get a healthy mix of players like Jarvis Landry, maybe not specifically Jarvis Landry, but consistent floor guys where I can see a path to more upside, and weekly ceiling players. I explained why I do this on the last episode. It gives you a nice cushion each week, all while allowing your team to have a better ceiling if those more volatile players end up blowing up. But I want to give the same disclaimer that I did during the mailbag show. Don't overstate what this all means. Jarvis Landry is more consistent, yes, but he's not so consistent to the point where he'll never post high-end weekly numbers. And the opposite is true too. In PPR leagues over the last three seasons, wide receivers who have had low coefficient of variations, so consistent wide receivers, include Demaryius Thomas, Antonio Brown, Rishard Matthews, Jarvis Landry, Eric Decker, Cole Beasley, and Larry Fitzgerald, just to name a few. I don't think any of those names are all that shocking. The thing you have to remember, though, is that this is not telling us how good these wide receivers are. It's telling us how consistent they are. One of the names that was most interesting on the list was actually Mike Wallace. But looking at Wallace's week-to-week output is pretty eye-opening. He hasn't hit 23 PPR points in a single game over the last 3 years, when it's been hit 365 times by a wide receiver over this span. All the while, he's hit 6 or more points in 38 games of the 44-game sample that I'm analyzing, which again, excludes all week 17s. And he's hit double-digit points in over half of them. That's why an exercise like this can be so helpful. You end up uncovering things that you may have thought were different. Now, an example like Wallace doesn't mean that I'll go into a season thinking, Mike Wallace is going to provide some really great consistency on my fantasy team. But I'll certainly be cognizant of the fact that he may not be the boom-type player that most think that he is. So again, some guys you could bucket as consistent going into this year, and I'll add some more players here, include Demaryius Thomas, Jarvis Landry, Golden Tate is another one, Pierre Garçon, John Brown, Jamison Crowder. You'll find high-volume slot guys are often consistent because they're not as touchdown dependent. On the opposite side, you have Martavis Bryant, AJ Green, Sammy Watkins, Tyler Lockett, Adam Thielen, Alshon Jeffrey, Marvin Jones, and Ted Ginn. We know these players are deep threats, and they're the more volatile types output-wise. So let's run through an exercise as to how I would then draft, given all of this information. Let's say I get AJ Green in the first round of my draft. He's elite. We know that he's elite. He's going to get top production, but he's also more volatile than an Antonio Brown-type wide receiver. If I get a running back in the second round, and then the late third round hits, I'd end up going with a Demaryius Thomas type over, say, Alshon Jeffrey. But if I were to get Alshon Jeffrey, another up and down type player, then I'd make sure to get a Jamison Crowder type in the fourth or the fifth round. It's all a balancing act. This is a big reason why I don't really agree with strictly using season-long projections to figure out rankings. You should be reactive to how your draft is going in order to create a roster that wins from both a ceiling and a floor standpoint week in and week out. This is really an exercise that's easiest for wide receivers too. Though a good way to think about running back consistency is to think about receiving ability, especially in PPR formats, versus touchdown upside. With someone like Eddie Lacy, for instance, I wouldn't pair him with Adrian Peterson. There's a lot of risk in doing that, since they'll probably be fairly touchdown dependent, and they may not see as much volume as you'd like out of a starting running back. But the touchdown upside is there, given the offenses that they're playing in. Pairing Lacy or Peterson in a wide receiver heavy approach with someone like Bilal Powell, that can be money. And then make sure that you have some upside with your third, fourth, and fifth running backs as well. So when I'm making tiers, I'm not just looking at projections and grouping players who are similar on that end. I don't think it's necessary to group Frank Gore with Adrian Peterson in a PPR league, even if they were to hypothetically be projected for similar season-long output totals. They're two completely different running backs, and grouping that way really helps balance my roster overall for floor and for ceiling. Appreciate you guys listening to this week's show. I hope you were able to at least learn a little bit of new information. As always, you can subscribe to the show by searching for the Late Round Podcast almost anywhere podcasts can be found. And if you love the show, do me a favor and go to iTunes and give it a rating and review. It will really go a long way to helping the show out. Thanks, guys. I'll have a mailbag episode out for you later in the week.